come, draw close, and feel the power of the Herd Stone. Your best location for Warhammer Fantasy Battle lore, hobby, and gameplay discussion. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Herd Stone, a Warhammer Fantasy Battle lore and occasional hobby podcast. I'm here with the usual suspects. Go ahead, everyone, and say hi and give us an update on how your hobby has been going.
I'll go first. This is Brian. You might know me as Rule on the Discord. I've been entrenched in the Summer Wa, NXL's Summer Wa, and I've just been trying to push through as many of these Night Goblins as I can. Been proven to be a little bit testing of my skills. I'm doing more wet blending, and I'm going to have to learn airbrush, so it's going to be very interesting if I'm able to finish in time.
Okay. I'm Kerry, and I go by KMorris27 on the Discord. I'm currently in the middle of assembling a Nipponese army for Warhammer's Army Project, which has been quite an interesting game of matching scales from different manufacturers.
What happened to the, wasn't it a high elf army or something like that for the WA that you had been tasked with?
I started 3 Sea Guard. I'm just coming to the end of my 4-week paternity leave. Painting and small baby don't go together very well, whereas assembling, you can leave something with an arm hanging off and fix it later. If you're halfway through doing a round of highlights, you can really mess it up if you get interrupted.
This is Evan. You know me as Durger on the Discord. First of all, congratulations to Kerry on the new kid. That's awesome. I've been working on my WA stuff as well, which is, ironically, Bretonnia, which is the subject of the podcast today. So it's perfect timing.
Yeah, so this is Hotsa Mike here. I go by Hotsa Mike on the interwebs. They call me Mike in real life. So what I've been doing this summer is I've been getting some games in. I've been meeting some new people in the area, playing a little bit, using my Beastmen, using my Bretonnians. With regards to painting, I've been working on some Beastmen, some Vestigor. I kind of jump around between different projects, and so work on Dark Elves, work on Bretonnians, work on Vestigor. I've met Brian here the last about twice in the last month or so to get some games in and help him learn some of the rules and stuff. He's been painting up his goblins and orcs, and they look great. And I actually didn't participate in the WA painting challenge. I kind of took a hard look at myself and said, you know, realistically, I'm just not probably going to complete it. And I'm just kind of like the nomadic kind of lifestyle of jumping around between projects that I'm kind of into at the moment. And so, yeah, that's what I've been doing with the Warhammers.
And Mike, exactly how many Vestigors does any self-respecting Beastman army need?
Yeah, so we play 2,500 points in my area. You know, I like to play kind of the grand tournament style. And as you may know, in a 2,500 point game, you can take about 1,250 points of special. And I had 40 Vestigor in a big horde that I painted last year, the old Pestigor models. And I really had a great time doing that. And then I was like, you know, these are the best unit in the army, and I really like them a lot. And why shouldn't I get 40 more? So I'm working on 40 more Vestigors. And so I have a 2,500 point list where I take about 75. And then I've got some, you know, other stuff that make up my core minimum and a few characters and a couple of units of Harpies because they're awesome.
You know, speaking of meeting other people, meeting Ryan and Mike and being able to play in person and in the area has done so much for my hobby personally. I just interacted with the hobby generally through painting and checking Reddit and looking at the Discord and posting, but something about playing in person and seeing just the amazing work that your opponents do. Ryan does incredible on his lizard men and his undead vampire counts, and Mike's dark elves and Bretonnians and beastmen and all that look fantastic. So it really pushes me personally to do as much painting as I can to try to get that full painted army look. I'm just very excited to finally hit that threshold of having a fully painted list on the table.
Yeah, it seems to be a pretty common theme that seeing other people's painted models is very motivating.
Yeah, I was just saying, me and Brian played earlier today, and you're looking at your own army across the table, and you've got a lot of it painted, and you're just kind of looking at the units that you have neglected for a few months or years that haven't quite gotten to the full painting status, and it makes you really feel bad about not giving those guys the coat of paint they deserve, and it really motivates you to go home and, you know, knock it out.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
My name is Ryan. I haven't gotten to game with Brian or Mike as much as I'd like to recently, but I've been painting on the WA, and I've been doing my Warriors of Chaos, the Tzeentch ones, and to correspond with this month's monthly challenge from the Discord, I've been painting a chariot, and I just have to finish some gems and some eyes and some plumes, and that's what I'll be done with. And I'm using the Tzeentch, I guess, Screamer Chariot with some Cypher Lords on top of it is what I've been doing for that. I'm looking forward to getting that army done so I can play with it. So that's what I'm really excited about.
It's been, from what we've seen on there, it looks really cool. So you've done a really nice job on that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, Ryan does a really good job of actually painting his entire army before he even uses it, which is a self-discipline that is lost on most of us, I think.
I pulled out that Orc and Goblin army that is definitely not completed, and we did play a good game with that one. But if I don't, I always end up, you know, moving on and then having half and half for a long, long time. And Carrie, have you been getting any games in? I guess with the new child, you probably have not. Is that right?
That's correct. My most regular partner is my partner, so no free time all round.
You're saying if one of you has some time, the other one very likely doesn't, is what I'm guessing.
Correct. And we've got our two-year-old daughter running around, so unlike when we had her, there's no option of sleeping newborn while we play.
I think a number of us understand that life. So before we begin talking about our topic today, which is the Bretonnian Army book, we're going to go over some of the lore and play styles of the book. Before we do that, has Games Workshop released anything that recently caught your eye that you might be interested in turning it into Warhammer Fantasy Battle models or an idea there?
Not for anything that I play, but what was that vampire? There's like a book they're releasing that has a cool vampire model attached to it for AOS. I'm not sure when that's supposed to come out, but that was the only model recently that I was like, oh wow, I would definitely get that.
They showed the new Warhammer Underworld Cities of Sigmar group of characters, and they look very Empire. You know, there's a witch hunter. It looks like there's a could be converted into a warrior priest. They look very cool. I hope the scale isn't too distracting, but I mean, if you're not super worried about the scale or anything like that, I think they would look fantastic.
Yeah, I think that's always the trouble you run into with some of the new AOS stuff. It's the scale creep a little bit.
Yeah, they do have a couple of those models, but I know the father and daughter witch hunter models that came out recently were really off scale with Empire or anything really that they might fit.
Some of the recent Cruel Boys releases, the Hobgrots look pretty great, and the Cruel Boy that's riding on top of the gigantic troll or something, I've thought about using as a stand-in for a giant in my list, just replacing the guy on top or something like that.
Oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's a cool orc giant. Okay, well, before we jump in, just remember to anyone listening, you can join us on the Warhammer Fantasy Discord and join in on the fun of discussing lore and games and battle reports and all that stuff. But today, we're going to jump into the faction lore of the Bretonnian Army book. We all read the Army book recently so that we could get through the lore. But let's start off with this. For someone who doesn't know anything about Warhammer Fantasy Battle, how would you describe this faction in its 8th edition incarnation, with the caveat for anyone listening, this is the 6th edition army book. It never got an update after 6th edition. So even in 8th edition, you're dealing with the 6th edition army book. How would you describe this faction?
Medieval knights, if King Arthur was real.
Yeah, I would just describe it as a very classic medieval fantasy world with knights fighting monsters and magic and things of that nature. I think it's kind of a quintessential view of a medieval human kingdom and very typical fantasy medieval kingdom.
Yeah, it's basically what if King Arthur and his knights were French? I'd say that's the basic gist of like the flavor of the book. And I think it's also important to note, Ryan already noted that it was a sixth edition book that never got updated, but it's also rumored that they had worked on an eighth edition book and possibly some models before they, you know, decided to change to the AOS game.
More's the pity.
When you're looking at the 8th edition books have a consistent narrative thread running through them that adds a little bit to the timeline each time. The final book before they blew up the world was Wood Elves, that ended with the Battle of Quinnells, where the Wood Elves had turned out in force with all their special characters to help the Bretonians in their civil war. So it's not a huge leap to see that the next step would be a Bretonian book, finishing how that battle ended.
Brian, can you add a description?
Sure. I actually was surprised that this was just a 6th edition book as opposed to an 8th edition book. I'm not incredibly familiar with the earlier edition books, just looking at 8th edition books, but it felt very well done for an earlier book. Just the artwork and kind of the flow and the theme of the book, I would say that it's really packs in the whole feel of Bretonnia.
Thank y'all for those descriptions. And since we've mentioned that this was a 6th ed book, and we know that books do change in every edition, and sometimes the lore and the kind of stylings change, how did this faction change from past editions like 5th or even before that?
So in terms of the imagery, we move from what in much earlier editions had been quite a vague French aesthetic that drew some inspiration from much later periods than we normally see within Warhammer lore. So prior to recording, Mike was talking about this, that within the old roleplay and Man of War material, we're very much dealing with Versailles-era France, lots of cannons, and Bretonnia and Man of War is one of the best factions for shooting things with gunpowder. And later editions, we have very much moved away from that into this is the honorable knightly faction. Going into 6th edition, they really tried to change that into something a lot more gritty and down to earth. If anyone's gone through the 5th edition book and played with 5th edition models, going into 8th edition, your peasants get uglier, your peasants get dirtier, your knights are a lot more hypocritical in their honour and their code of chivalry, and there's a lot more hints that this is a lot darker in reality than on the boilerplate that they tell everyone.
Their Bretonnian feudal systems turned up to 11.
This is the book that brings in the 90% tax yield.
Right.
Actually, on the vows page. And no more than a tenth share shall you keep for your kith and kin. If anyone has any idea of economic systems, 90% taxing your peasants kills your peasants. Very straightforward. You have dead peasants.
I don't know that Warhammer Fantasy was ever known for trying to create a viable world built for an economic system. But yes, that's probably the most transgressive of all. Well, I don't know. There's some pretty bad economic systems in the Warhammer world, but this is one of the bad ones.
Don't orcs trade in teeth?
But that works. The teeth regrow.
And that makes perfect sense. Come on.
So mechanically, we go from an army that essentially used rules that were completely different to everything else, used triangular formations, which were a nightmare. And when the game designers were in White Dwarf talking about what they'd changed and why, they had run into some major issues with the old lance formation, this triangle, whereby it was very good on the charge, but it also worked very well as a defensive formation within 6th edition rules, which sounds ridiculous, but because of how ranks worked and how step-up worked at the time, or lack of step-up, you essentially had something that worked as a battering ram and a castle on the field.
You're just saying mechanically, because usually you'd have like a character in the front, and that was like the proto-character wall?
Well, no, because everyone who was on the front of the triangle, so both the tip and all the way up the side, could fight, you actually had more models who could fight than a normal ranked-up unit of cavalry coming the other way.
But not on the charge.
If we're talking about the old triangle formation, not on the charge, you would get charged by, say, some Reichsguard, and you would actually have more attacks back than they did, even though they charged.
Yeah.
The change was positive in many ways. The issue is, this worked very well within 6th edition. As we're going to see later on, The list in 8th edition relies on certain things to prop it up, whereas some things haven't aged very well.
Absolutely. Unless someone has some knowledge of some pre-6th edition stuff.
Going into 6th edition, what we saw was a mass culling of special characters. And so Bretonnia never got those put back in place after this cull happened. So Bretonnia, we have 3 special characters, 6th edition, 2 or 3 was standard. They're competing against army books in 8th, where 6 to 8 characters, it becomes the standard. So in terms of just personalities, they're at a bit of a disadvantage in terms of who they can put on the field.
Maybe someone else also knows some of the characters they lost, like Rapance.
Yeah, so if you look back, I have my 5th edition book in front of me. If you look back at the 5th edition book, it's got about 4 or 5 pages just full of special characters, different dukes, Baelman the Beast Slayer, Otto de Outremer, Bertrand the Brigand, these kind of special characters who had their own models, Réponse de Leonese. Sorry if I'm butchering all these pronunciations, but there was, like Kay Morris said, a huge culling of these special characters between 5th and 6th edition. And as Carrie had touched on earlier, it's really interesting. If you look at even the model aesthetic from 5th edition to 6th edition, you really see kind of the men-at-arms and the peasant bowmen and the squires especially. You see kind of a richer, more properly maintained peasant military force. And then by the time you get to 6th edition, I mean, they're basically described as like humans that are basically as diseased and poor and filthy as you could possibly contemplate. Pretty stark kind of difference you see there.
The big irony of cutting all those characters is in the 6th edition model range, both of the generic lord models are special characters. So Bohemond didn't have a model in 5th edition, but the generic Bretonnian lord with lance model in 6th is him, and they're quite clear on this in the army book, whereas the fellow with the axe is Theodoric of Brionne. And I don't think we really had any other factions who did not have a generic character model for their combat characters.
So they cut the special character rules, but gave them models.
But gave them models, so...
Interesting.
You can't play as Bohemond anymore, but you're going to have to use him because we haven't given you a generic option.
I've had the pleasure of playing against Mike's Bretonnians. Who's the character that maybe Robin Hood-like that you have painted and you use him as archers?
I saw those today.
My Bretonnian army is heavily 5th edition, and I take 2 units of 10 peasant archers, usually at 2,500 points, and my models are all the 5th edition metal Bretonnian squire models. So they're kind of theoretically, you know, richer peasants, and they would be in skirmish formation and stuff, but I use them as peasants, and included in that is Bertrand the Brigand, and he's accompanied by the characters that represent Friar Tuck and Little John. I forget what their Warhammer fantasy names are exactly. Yeah, I've got those guys, and they just give some character to the archer unit and make them, you know, fun to look at on the tabletop.
Yeah, Mike has a great looking 5th edition army, and after battles, you can see some of the pictures of his up on battle reports on the Discord, so I encourage anyone that wants to go do that. So let's go ahead, and we're going to now move over to talking about the lore of the book. Let's start out with just the design of the book, or just how it's put together.
Yeah, I really wanted to speak on this just as somebody coming in from the outside and never really seeing Bretonnia in play whenever I was growing up. I started as a kid, and people at my local shop played elves, they played Empire. Nobody really played Bretonnia, so I never really got to see a full list. And then I exited the hobby before this book came out. But after reading this book and going through this book, I really feel like I get Bretonnia now. I get the appeal. I get the imagery. The first part of the book is like medieval tapestry. It was just very cool to open the book and see it laid out with the story told and with tapestries to go with it. And then you see all the heraldry going down and all the different houses and who they pay their allegiance to. And I feel like that if I had been the age in the hobby at the age that this was released, and I just picked up the book and was flipping through it in the store, I totally would have been interested in picking up Bretonnia as a faction myself.
Now, as we touched upon earlier, this feels very high quality for a 6th edition book. And one of the main reasons of it is how they've used colour.
Yes.
Most of the 6th edition books, you had a limited colour section with only models in. But the Bretonnian one, you go in and after the introduction page, you're into a 2-page spread that they've kept relatively monochrome, but have put colour into it, even within a limited spectrum. And then you're into the lore in full colour. And the map, you know, the map's in full colour, the heraldry section's in full colour. This is head and shoulders above most of the other 6th edition books and is more in line with the 7th edition style of more colour on the page. And it really does mean this book aged better than any of the others would have done from the same era.
Yeah, I really like the tapestry that Brian mentioned, where it's talking about these 12 great battles that were fought for the creation of Bretonnia. So briefly, what's that tapestry about?
So the Bretonni were a peoples above the Grey Mountains who didn't join Sigma in uniting the Empire. They essentially keep ticking over for another almost 1,000 years before their great calamity comes, and everyone attacks their different little petty kingdoms at once. The Lady of the Lake, whose identity gets controversial later on, appears to the Duke of Bastogne. Now, we didn't actually do the apology for poor pronunciation yet, so I'll put it in here. There's a lot of French-style spellings in this book and in this lore. We're going to have both varied pronunciation and very incorrect pronunciation as we go along. Please accept our apologies on this. So she appears to a duke called Giles, who is charged with saving the kingdom and uniting the kingdom. He forms you can either look at it as the Knights of the Round Table through Arthurian mythology, or the Paladins of Charlemagne, if you want to go more French. But he forms a crack team of special characters who fight a 12 battle campaign, Arthurian style, mostly against orcs, though they try and mix it up and fight night goblins at one point. They fight the Norse at one point. They fight the Skaven for the finale, and they do the undead in the middle somewhere. But the tapestry covers these battles. It can get a little bit repetitive when they have an interesting one and then, oh, they better fight some orcs again to pad it out. If you are familiar with your Arthurian mythology, the 12 battles of Arthur is what they're basing this on. And there's padding in those 12 battles as well. So don't be hugely surprised with that.
They did it within a short period. It seemed like it was like they went from battle to battle, which I thought was an interesting thing, right? It wasn't like uniting Bretonnia over years. It was this very short period, 12 battles. They beat some army and then go to the next one.
Yeah. All of their enemies have come out of the woodwork at the same time and have chosen to besiege every single castle and population center at the same time.
Now, the uniting Bretonnia speed run.
Now, what you could read out of this is that this could actually represent a decade's worth of battles, and this is in-universe lore condensing that into this single grand pilgrimage of let's kill everyone.
We can't always trust an army book to tell us the truth.
No, there's nothing really objective in an army book lore section when it's written in character. You just have to take it with a pinch of salt. This is what my army believes.
So what happens next for Bretonnia?
Oh, Giles dies. Giles dies hard, Arthur style, and is taken into another world, very much King Under the Mountain, return when he is needed.
Well, he goes out on a boat, right? Like he's out on the lake, since that's the focus of Bretonnia.
Goes out on the lake, and we get a very final sounding, thus ends the majestic history of Giles the Breton, at least until we skip forward another 50-odd pages and can use him as a special character, hint, hint.
He also is killed in an unsavory way. A missile weapon of some sort
kills
him. And this is why Bretonnians refuse to use missiles. missile weapons. Their peasants can because they're below notice, but yeah, no Bretonian of worth will use a missile weapon. So who comes after that?
So each of the companions in Giles's special character quest brigade become a duke within this new political unit. Each dukedom has its own personality, and later on you can reflect that personality in the virtue that you choose for your characters, which is very nice, very fluffy. But really, the next big thing that happens to Bretonnia is when the not at all controversial region of Araby invades Estalia and Tilia, and we get the Crusades. The fact that Araby at the time is ruled by Jafar tells you just how maturely written this is, and a lot of Bretonnian law and some of those special characters we talked about being cut are based around this crusader mentality and aesthetic of overseas wars against people who are threatening not Europe.
Those are not the only of these type of war. They kind of spawn a type of war called an errantry war, right?
Yeah, so they branch out. Following the Crusades, we get this idea of crusading type war for a set reason.
Evan, can you tell us more about what you liked about the errantry wars?
So as Kerry mentioned, they go on these crusades to Araby, and after they help drive Jafar and his men back to Araby, there's like 3 years of fighting that takes place. And they take all their plunder back to Bretonnia. There was also a second group of knights that had meant to join the crusade over land, but that by the time they were meant to arrive, the fighting was over. And so some of these knights ended up settling in the region known as the Border Princes, which feature in the Dogs of War army book.
Yeah, I really liked that idea of this group of Bretonnians is too late because the Bretonnians are so successful in this errantry war that they're over. And so then they're just like, well, here's some bad lands where orcs are and we hate orcs. Let's drive them out and create some principalities.
The book also mentions that they go into like the lands of the Tomb Kings, and also even into the New World to fight the Lizardmen, which I thought was interesting. And it's a nice justification just in the context of the game of Warhammer fantasy battles that you can create any sort of scenario where Bretonnia might be fighting any of the other factions of the game. So that's kind of interesting. Bretonnian kings can call an errantry war, which is basically an open invitation for fledgling knights errant to join the king's army in completing a certain objective. Thereby, they might earn the title of Knight of the Realm. One of these errantry wars was called by King Lewin Orcslayer in the year 2201 against the Greenskins that were plaguing Bretonnia, which I thought was interesting because that's set very close to the time period of the Three Emperors, which is the rumored time period for the Old World game. So if we get a updated Bretonnia army in the new game that they're working on, it's very likely that King Lewin Orcslayer would be maybe a special character, or at least be the background king for the faction lore at that time.
So you're saying on one of the five maps that we've received for the Old World, the Bretonnians who are on some of those maps will be in that period.
Yes, hopefully.
On the topic of the errantry wars, I really liked King Charlène, who started an errantry war to, in his eyes, rid the world of greenskins.
Pretty ambitious.
Even in a pro Brett book, it was, and he wasn't that bright thinking he could actually do that.
And it lasted for like 60 years or something like
that. And it bled Bretonnia dry, and like, you know, a bunch of the provinces were weakened greatly until King Philippe V ended it. It said basically like if he hadn't ended it, Bretonnians still gone on this really dumb war just to save their honor. But he was smart in ending it. Anyway, I liked that one. I thought it was.
Yeah, before we leave the subject of kind of the errantry wars and the Bretonnians hanging out in Araby and doing their thing over there, I would just like to point out, connecting this to the hobby side of things, when I was first getting into the hobby, there was a White Dwarf that came out, White Dwarf 277, and it's actually when Tomb Kings were released. Tomb Kings were a new army in 6th edition, and they were released, and usually when an army was released back in the early 2000s, they would have a battle report. The battle report for February 2003 is actually Bretonnians versus Tomb Kings with a Tomb Kings kind of setting. And the gentleman who's playing Bretonnians actually has a very beautifully painted Bretonnian army that's all in kind of a Knights Templar, you know, George cross, white plane with a red cross kind of aesthetic. And it's a very fun battle report, and it's an homage to these Bretonian errantry wars we've been talking about, going to the land of the Tomb Kings and doing things. So it's a really fun battle report and a nice white dwarf if you can find it anywhere online.
It's really interesting that you say that, because I was going through the book and I just thought it was common for the armies to just be painted where every single knight comes from their own house. That thought actually crossed my mind. If there's a people who decide to paint their army under a single banner, under a single color scheme, that's really cool. The errantry wars would absolutely fit under a situation where it would make sense both lore-wise and hobby-wise for it to be united look.
Yeah, hobby-wise, that White Dwarf really inspired me when I was a teenager to start collecting the old 5th edition models and to actually do an army in the kind of George Cross, Knights Templar type of aesthetic. But I kind of got away from that as I got older and went back to the every knight has his own colors. But nobody gets to wear green. That's the only rule.
That battle report actually has a sequel when this Bretonian book came out. One of their inaugural battles is the rematch.
I don't recall that one, but you're probably right.
It's all based on, it's the grandson of the Bretonian general from that battle report trying to get his grandfather's remains back. And so the grandfather's walking around as a grail reliquary with pilgrims as an objective.
That's fantastic.
That is awesome. It gets at how cool the lore can be and build on itself, and how cool the hobby can be, whether it's, you know, at GW headquarters doing it through White Dwarfs and stuff, but you can do these stories yourself if you take the game and take the lore and the models and kind of do what you want with them. You can have a lot of fun. Are there any other things in the faction lore? What else happens to Bretonnia? We don't have to know everything, but, you know, what are some other main things we might want to know about Bretonnia?
So Bretonnia is the setting for the earliest special character that was ever introduced to Warhammer, Heinrich Kemmler, the Lichmaster. And very prominently, he appeared in a couple of three-way battle scenarios with the undead Bretonnia and Skaven around La Maison-Tal Abbey. And so this location gets worked into the lore because it featured in a couple of supplements that were very influential and very important in their time, all the way through to the world blowing up, La Maison-Tal showing up in novels and things. The gist of it is that Kemmler is after artifacts and the Bretonnians want to stop him getting artifacts. And this creates a recurring grudge between him and the Dukes of Quinelles that he loses a battle, he kills a duke, the next duke chases him, so on and so on. But it means that if you are wanting to sort of look at these scenario, you know, a scenario that's got a bit of a background to it, you don't just look in the Bretonnian book. You look at who their enemies are, who their special characters are in other books, who can bring that flavor to a battle for you.
Because the Bretonnia book, this is a paragraph or two. I mean, very short, this Kemmler and along with Krell fighting and Tancred defeating. But as you're speaking to, it's just the tip of the iceberg of the depth of the lore.
That same battle happens like four times, I think.
We definitely see Heinrich Kemmler show up in some of the White Dwarfs from the early 2000s. But the three-way battle with the vampires, the Skaven, and the Bretonnians is a classic.
I feel like this book has a lot of battles that are multiple armies. And part of this is what Kerry mentioned when we covered Drakenfels, was that earlier in Warhammer, there were a lot more connections of the evil armies kind of just being together, fighting together. It didn't feel quite like that mishmash in this book, but there were still a number of times it was like, the undead are there, also some Skaven, and let's throw in some chaos stuff as well. There was a little bit of that. There were also some battles that were, you know, the Wood Elves and the Bretonnians. So I noticed a number of times that there were battles that included three or four different factions.
And what an interesting and complicated relationship the Bretonnians and the Wood Elves have.
We've talked about the all the companions from Giles's original 12 became dukes. They really put a lot of more effort into expanding one of them than the others.
Yeah, Moussillon, as I will pronounce it, is really important in the history of Bretonnia. It's a port city along the coast, with the city itself being at the mouth of the river Grimmery or Grismery. I don't know how you would pronounce it, but that cuts across Britonia from east to west. It's important for a few reasons. It's a place where disgraced knights gather. It's a dukeless kingdom, and it's had a few former rulers of note. Under Gilles, when he was still uniting Britonia, it was the kingdom of Landwein, his most trusted companion and one of the original three Grail Knights, who was a hero in his own right. When Gilles dies, Landwein goes into a malaise and allows his kingdom to fall into shambles. And it's implied that the land itself is cursed in Moussillon. It sits on a swampland. It's constantly battling flooding and like Skaven and undead. They just run rampant here.
I like the explanation that because it's a swamp, they can't bury the dead deeply enough. And so the cemeteries are above ground. And it hints that it's, you know, there's some problems with that in a world that has undead.
Right. Yeah. It's like prime location for dark sorcerers and necromancers to like find chattel and stuff. So as I mentioned before, there's a couple fun characters throughout the kingdom's history, one of which is Duke Merovec, who during a time of plague and Skaven infestation, like all throughout Britonia, decided this was like his opportunity to like win honor as the Duke of Moussillon. So he like rides out.
Is this the period when, like, if someone were to read the Warhammer books, when the Black Plague books occur, or is it a different time period?
I think they called it the Red Pox.
So the Red Pox was the attempt by the Skaven to do a sequel to the Black Plague. It wasn't as successful.
So Merovec wins some pretty heroic victories, but during the battle, he kind of alarms the soldiers of the other dukedoms because of his bloodlust in battle. He's like hacking at corpses. And after winning a great victory and saving the kingdom of Perivon, he invites the king and the other dukes to his court for a feast to celebrate their victory. And in his dining hall, he has like the mutilated and tortured bodies of his enemies and criminals like strung up on the walls, which obviously weirded everyone out. So like the king's totally aghast. And Merovec's like unrepentant. He's like, these people are so ungrateful. I've just saved like the whole kingdom. Why are they so pissed at me? So the king challenges Merovec to a duel, which Merovec wins, cuts out the throat of the king, and like in front of everyone, drains the blood from his body and drinks it from a chalice, which obviously the most disgusting thing these dukes have ever seen in their lives. So they eventually go and gather like their armies, and there's, you know, some battles and stuff, and they eventually kill Merovec, but he was a pretty bad dude.
I just want to say we're 2 for 2 on books that have really horrific dinners.
Yeah. Yeah, a little bit of callback to Drakenfels for sure. Another Duke of note from Moussillon, and there's kind of a running theme here. I don't know if it's intended, but a lot of these people that are from Moussillon all have names that start with M. Not sure why, but so another Duke named Maldred becomes famous for what is known as the Affair of the False Grail. And I think this is more detailed, not so much in the army book itself, but there's like some Warhammer Fantasy roleplay second edition like supplements that touch on this. But he basically tries to usurp the throne. He imprisons the Fae Enchantress, and then he claims to be in possession of the actual Grail, like the Grail from the Lady of the Lake, which is obviously a fake. But there's a whole story about that in that Warhammer roleplay book, I believe. And then also it's mentioned towards like the end of the lore sections in this book that there's a mysterious leader uniting the forces of Moussillon again, like during the current timeline. And I believe in the end times, we learn that it's possibly Malabad, who's rumored to be Lewin's bastard son. He's kind of an interesting character in his own right. And I think you can read more about that in the End Times Nagash book.
He really comes to fore in one of the roleplay supplements, and they pad out who his court is. He comes into it again in some of the novels we're going to touch upon later. Once you get to End Times, it's actually happened, and they're talking about it in the past tense. This happened last year and has all been resolved. The kingdom's in ruins. We've had the civil war. Oh, I'm sorry. It was off screen.
Right.
If we had had the 8th edition Britonia book, we would have probably had quite a bit of a spotlight on what was going on there.
Yeah, you wonder if it was kind of a summation of what they were planning for the faction.
I did have a question about the Red Duke. So they've got these named leaders of Moussillon that maybe are vampires or become vampires and stuff like that. But I always wondered, is the Red Duke a recurring, the same guy, or is this like false Red Dukes that, you know, someone else is claiming the name, or is the each leader this actually the same dude just shows back up? They think they defeat him.
He's from different dukedom, I believe. The Red Duke is.
He's from Aquitaine.
I really like how GW did this with some books where there's a lot of provinces and where they go really deep into one or two provinces or territories or tribes or whatever of the faction, and then lists a bunch of others and basically says, now do with these what you will. Here's a really loose idea, but you can take it and run with it. Or you could play this very specific one that is fleshed out.
Yeah, that was something I always thought was so great about Warhammer Fantasy Battles when I was growing up, was like you had a world and you had a setting and there was lore, but it wasn't that deep. You could take it and run with it yourself. It's really so threadbare in so many ways, and there's so much room to develop and explore this world.
And just now looking at the Bretonian heraldry page, it's really interesting because if you go look at the Moussillon heraldry, they have Malabad's serpent at the end of it, but he's not really in this book per se in the lore section, but he was already a character, and it was like someone they drew in later when they were writing those stories.
I wanted to touch on a revelation that Evan had about how they had just M names for everybody, and I made the connection that Maldred was GW's version of Mordred, going back to the Arthurian legend. It's funny that they stuck with the M, because I believe in Arthurian legend, Mordred was the illegitimate son of his half-sister Morgana or something like that. So they must have saw that connection and just decided it's kind of funny, the two M names. Let's just make them all M's.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the defining characteristics that shows up in all the lore, and especially like in the 12 battles at the very beginning, is that lance formation. I think that the lance formation is a really cool design within the lore, right? Like of this great strong charge, and then they followed it up with a gameplay. And sometimes you'll see something with GW that there's a really cool description of it, then the gameplay is like, so you can model it this way,
right,
or whatever. But the lance formation is essential to what the Bretonians are, and then you see it in the book, and it's this beautiful columns of knights that are all differently painted. So I really like the lance formation as a lore thing that they set it up, but also a very specific design characteristic in the way the army plays.
Yeah, I mean, just aesthetically, when you see a Bretonian army on the table, you immediately know what you're looking at. Because, like you said, because of those columns of knights, it's unmistakable. You're not going to confuse that for any other army just at a glance.
A heretic would take Bretonian knights not in a lance formation, right, Mike?
I've been known to run five knights as a kind of a flanking unit, kind of a heavy flanking unit. That free champion really helps.
It's true. Free champion.
Well, I guess it's included in the price of using the army. I don't know.
Right. You're already paying over the odds for a lot of this stuff, which we'll get into.
And I could see myself running three Grail Knights. It's not technically the lance formation.
So before 6th edition, they were getting a free banner bearer per unit. And so, again, it was one of these changes where they wanted to make it more about the challenges than it was about the free point of combat res.
Good change.
It's another one of those things where they put the lore into the rules in a way that really fits. Some of the coolest stuff that has been mentioned before is just the way you can use vows and those types of things. And then, Mike, can you tell us some about that fun stuff?
So I've been playing Bretonians for a really long time. And when the 6th edition book came out, you kind of really start to get, these are kind of the army special rules that you'd find in other factions. Usually there's a page in the army book that kind of details the army special rules. Some of the other armies I play, like Beastmen, have a Primal Fury, which is one of the best special rules.
This isn't a Beastmen book review.
Yeah. One of the only things that makes Beastmen viable. But anyways, the Bretonians have vows. They're connected to the lore, of course. So from a lore perspective, you live in this feudal society and you have these knights that are climbing the ladder of knightly society. You start as a knight errant, and then you become a knight of the realm. And then it's possible that you take a questing vow and become a questing knight. And then if you are able to complete your quest, to become a Grail Knight. And so then you also additionally have the peasant's duty, which even is a nod to the peasants, that they have a special rule for them for being in the society and looking up to their knightly overlords. So each of these five different vows or duties can different special rules in the gameplay. So the most basic vow that all the knights have makes them immune to panic, for instance, from other units. The peasant's duty allows peasants within 6 inches of their parent unit to use the knight's leadership, even without the general. The questing knights have a little more powerful vow. They reroll fear and terror tests. And then you have the Grail vow, which makes them immune to psychology. So you progressively get more powerful vows as you go up in the knightly world. Then you have the second special rules page, which is a universal rule which applies to the entire Bretonian army. You have what's known as the Blessing of the Lady, which is the concept that before battles commenced, you have your Bretonian army, your host, asking for the Blessing of the Lady, which will help them win the battle. And how that translates to actual gameplay is in exchange for conceding the ability to roll off for the first turn, you conferred ward saves. Everyone in the army that's a knight is given a ward save that is a 6+ for strength 4 below and a 5+ for strength 5 and above. This includes the damsels and the prophetesses, your wizards and your Bretonian army, but it doesn't include the peasants except for the Grail Reliquary peasants. It's a very powerful army special rule that really helps out the Bretonians. It's very lore and faction specific and interesting, and it's one of the kind of the treasures of the Bretonian army. Break from combat or flee for any reason, you'll lose the Blessing of the Lady. You're kind of a disgraced knight after that. You just have to rely on your armor save.
Well, before we move on from lore, we've kind of done the large outline. Did anyone have favorite lore sections or stories? Is there something you thought, this is really cool, I definitely want people to know about this?
Yeah, I do. I'm actually really taken by the role of questing knights in Bretonian society. I think the lore and the writing behind the concept of having these knights make a pseudo-religious vow to seek the Grail and to never spend a night in two places, to abstain from any type of frivolous conduct, to abstain from the pleasures of the world, and to, you know, basically live in poverty and to go out and to seek this higher goal and this thing that is, you know, about purity and virtue and doing the right thing and protecting the weak. And I think the imagery of thinking about a knight out on this quest for months or years, and the lore would tell you that it's not often successful.
When I was rereading the book, the part that really I enjoyed reminded me of a Monty Python film, which would not be the one you'd probably think it would be, but when they're talking about the Grail Reliquary and how the Grail pilgrims are such fanboys, they kind of annoy the Grail knights and they follow them around and they latch onto every word that they might say. It reminds me of the scene from Life of Brian where he keeps saying, I'm not the Messiah, and the people are just like, well, I say you are and I should know, I followed a few.
In fairness, if the person with glowing eyes says they're not the Messiah, you can tell they're lying a little bit.
Yeah. Just that whole idea of them being like fanboys to the Grail Knights just cracks me up.
I do love the couple of times when it gives call outs to the peasants taking, I guess, their own destiny into their hands, sometimes intentionally and sometimes not. Right. Like when they play a game called Smell the Gauntlet that leads to a peasant's revolt in the year 1593. I don't know what game Smell the Gauntlet is that it got so out of hand. But then they like banned the game after they put down the peasant revolt.
Hopefully that's GW's next Warhammer community article for the old world.
It's titled Smell the Gauntlet.
Smell the Gauntlet.
Yeah. With a new map piece.
My favorite part is actually quite obscure, but it's Marcus of Bordelais, one of those companions. When they get to the city of L'Anguillai, they fight the Norse. And this is resolved by a challenge to single combat between Marcus and the Norse war chief, who we'll essentially say is a Chaos Lord who chooses to go around topless. And they fight on top of the lighthouse, and Marcus wins. Nice and straightforward. Until you get to the picture of this, and you realise they're about 1,000 feet up. And then the penny drops that Langwellai is actually the elven ruins of Tor Elise. This is the biggest high elf city that used to be in the old world. They're on top of a giant high elf lighthouse that's still standing 1,000 years later. They've had the challenge to single combat. They've agreed to fight on the lighthouse. They've then climbed the steps for 1,000 feet. This is the equivalent of you've called someone out to a duel with pistols, and then you've gone single file up the steps of the Eiffel Tower to very politely waiting, because obviously you're not going to be at the same pace, are you? The Chaos Lord is a good 3 feet taller than Marcus in the picture. There's going to be some patient waiting for the other person to get up. No one's gone for a backstab on the way up. No one's gone for a trip and could have ended it now. Nice and civil.
It's the Princess Bride. Yeah.
You know, just as a spoiler for what might come in a future month, this is not the first time that someone has had to climb really high and then go and have a 1v1 combat with someone else. So we may see more of this in the future of this podcast.
It's a great piece of art, though. Really cool.
This might sound crazy given the 6th edition version of Britonia, but I feel like, and Carrie might be able to speak to this, the concept of a peasant being able to lift themselves up into knighthood based on some sort of heroic feat on the battlefield. Is that a concept in Britonia that maybe I'm crazy, maybe I'm having a fever dream, but I feel like that there's something to that.
It's mentioned in the timeline as happening 3 times, and the third recipient doesn't survive their first battle. It's mentioned elsewhere in the lore, I can't remember where, that when this does happen, the surrounding knights make sure the peasant doesn't survive their first battle.
The concept of someone lifting themselves up out of obscurity and proving themselves on the battlefield is a fun concept, but Warhammer makes fun of it, I guess.
Well, Britonia hasn't developed to the point where it has a concept of a middle class, so there isn't any stepping stone between peasantry and nobility yet. They've obviously got mounted yeomen who are supposed to be the richer peasants, but that's as high as you go. Historically, this yeoman archers within the English army at the time are seen as one of the stepping stones towards a concept of a middle class.
But we don't let too much of the real world get involved here, and that's why there will always be just enough knights to meet what is needed in the Warhammer world, even if none are raised up and they're constantly dying.
I've always liked that lore answer about, you know, how many swordsmen would it take to destroy a chosen? And it's like, well, how many does the story necessitate? That's how many it takes. Which kind of leads me a little bit into my favorite lore bit. Ryan touched on it earlier with King Sharlan and his bumbling through his rule. And I don't want to be the orc guy that likes the orc parts, but it was a little bit of levity in that section of the lore, how even the biased lore book was kind of just giving him a hard time over it, especially after just 2 paragraphs before it. It was the massive successes of King Lewin Orcslayer doing all this great work, and then it immediately goes into King Sharlan bumbling around the Border Princes.
Because what you don't have in this book, but you do have if you've read the Orc Army book, is you know what happens to that last army that rides into Death Pass. Imperial year 2488, mighty host of knights ride forth in Death Pass and don't return, and the king declares the errantry wars at an end. Now, if you read the Orc book, you know that at the other end is Morglum Necksnapper saying, go back and tell your king the east belongs to the orcs, the east is green. So what GW did was take what they've put in earlier books and riff off it later to expand it for the armies that were at the other end of that.
Some fun continuity there.
Absolutely. I liked the heraldry section, which was one of those really fantastic art sections. But the reason I liked it as a lore section, as I've mentioned with a couple other things, is I like what it allows you to do with your army. It tells a little bit of story about the heraldry of each different province, and it'll, you know, show this one's a lion. It's got a lion on the shield because someone hunted a lion in it. It has those types of things. But I also just like that it shows just how much you can do with the army. I liked that it had cool things from what you might think of as English heraldry and some as we think of as like French heraldry. And so I liked that, that it kind of brought those two together, as we've mentioned. And the story I liked from that was Theodric of Briance has an axe as his heraldry. So you'd think, oh, he uses an axe and he's really good with an axe. But it's actually that he was fighting in a battle and his opponent had a massive axe and buried it in his shield and almost struck him down. But he was so powerful that he then killed the guy that put the axe in his shield, but no one could get the axe out. So he fought the rest of the day with an axe in his shield and fought bravely anyway. So I liked that story.
Before we escape, since Ryan was talking about the heraldry, there's just something I have to mention because I'm kind of known for it on the internet. And that's like, if you look at this sixth edition book, you will not see one Bretonian knight wearing green. All right. And I see a lot of people on the internet painting their Bretonian knights in green. And I just want to point out that that is not cool. All right. Bretonian knights do not wear green.
Why not, Mike? Unless Evan's painting them. Why did they not wear green?
I don't think it touches on it in the sixth edition army book. At least I don't recall it. But I think in the Black Library book, Knights of Bretonia, or maybe it was in one of the Warhammer roleplay supplements, it mentions that Bretonian knights don't wear green because green is a color reserved for the peasants, the lower classes.
And the Green Knight?
Yeah, the Green Knight as well.
One more thing, just touching on the Bretonian heraldry page, is a lot of these names on here for the different dukedoms are, if there's any listeners that play the Total War games, if you play the Bretonian campaign, a lot of the paladins that you can recruit have names from these pages, which is kind of cool that the creators of that game went back to this book and looked through for inspiration.
We're coming to the close of the lore section, but if someone wants to read more lore about this, where should they look?
So Black Library did do a trilogy of books dedicated to Bretonian Knight and their series of quests and rising up through the different hierarchies of Bretonian society. And this does actually delve quite deep into what's going on currently in Maelyssant and the undead politics there. We've also got a book dedicated to the Red Duke, who was a Duke of Aquitaine who assassinated while on crusade, but got turned into a vampire because a vampire just happened to be passing and was impressed with his last stand. And as I mentioned earlier, we have got quite a bit of Bretonian material in the early End Times novels, particularly Return of Nagash. But you do find yourself thinking, this feels like a sequel to something they didn't write. So it's very interesting, and you get to touch base with a lot of Bretonian characters, but you do feel like you're late to the party.
Thanks. If we're just looking at lore, what unit did you think was the coolest?
Like I touched on earlier, if you're just looking at the lore, I think the lore surrounding the questing knights is the coolest. I think of the hierarchy of knights, knights errant, knights of the realm, questing knights, and grail knights, I think that phase of the knightly journey is kind of the most intriguing to me.
Yeah, I have to agree. The journey and the role that they play in society and how that translates to the models. And you get the feeling that there's just a lot of background to characters on the tabletop that a lot of armies don't have, it seems like.
Mine's probably the peasant bowman. You get the defensive stakes as an option for them. And we really don't see very much by way of like battlefield fortifications in any other armies. And this feels very appropriate, very fluffy. Ultimately, I'm a fan of Cressy. I'm a fan of Agincourt and that kind of asymmetrical warfare with knights versus bowmen. Even though the army book is trying to put them down and explain that they're dishonorable, that makes them more interesting to me. Plus, if your 6-point longbowmen outperform your knights, it's just hilarious.
For me, I do think that the Grail Reliquary is pretty cool. We kind of mentioned how annoying they can be to the Grail Knights. They really just want to be near the Grail Knights, and yet the Grail Knights really don't want to be near them. And then my favorite part is when it's mentioned that it's distinctly possible that in a rush to get relics from a Grail Knight, when a Grail Knight dies, that it's distinctly possible that the battle pilgrims, or who would become battle pilgrims, actually killed the Grail Knight that was injured, but perhaps could have been saved. But these peasants were so anxious to get relics that they ended up killing the Grail Knight that they would then worship. Okay, we've talked about the beauty of these models. We've talked about some changes between 5th edition and, I guess, the 6th edition models. But from what you saw in the section of the book that had all the models and the pictures of them and whatnot, what is your favorite unit as far as just aesthetics go? What?
Actually, the damsels. The damsels, especially in the book, are so well done. And the sculpts themselves are just look fantastic with the flowing robes and the hair. Their overall pose, whether they're on horse or they're just standing, it makes for really cool paint projects that you see people in the Discord do or anything like that. It's probably one of the most well done mage characters that I've seen in a lot of the armies.
Yeah, so I have a pretty extensive Bretonian army myself, and I'm kind of known for being a grognard and collecting old models. So my favorite Bretonian model is the 5th edition Grail Knight Champion, which is a model that is a knight with his helmet open, and he's using a two-handed sword, and he's kind of in the motion of swinging. The model might technically have a name associated with it, but it doesn't come to mind. But I use him as my lord and in my gameplay these days. And I had a friend of mine commission paint him for me, and it's an absolutely beautiful model, and it has a beautiful paint job, and I love it to death.
So the whole plastic range for Bretonnia, when it came out, Games Workshop was doing some very interesting things with how they were doing arms and torsos. So when you look at the Knight of the Realm, Errant Knight models, so you're into torso with shield arm already positioned and in pose. With the Men-at-Arms models, we're into shoulder to elbow is part of the torso and legs as one piece. And what this means is you've got a lot less issues with assembly and ranking up than you do with some of the other 6th edition with like such as the Empire, where you've got an awful lot of flexibility. But certainly when you're just starting out in the hobby, when you might be sort of 10, 12, you can end up with a very good looking unit that is very forgiving when you start trying to be a little bit creative when you don't really know what you're doing. That's really stuck with me from collecting these when I was about 12, 13. And the result you get from these plastics was a lot more reliable. It didn't necessarily give you as much creative freedom, but the result was a lot more solid than some of the other sets at the same time.
Yeah, one of my favorite units is the Men-at-Arms as far as just the way it looks. And the knights are lovely, and I love them. They look great when painted individually, but as far as medieval styled army, I love the Men-at-Arms. I love the metal helmets that they have and the style of shield that they have. And then with the dual colors, there's just something about those Men-at-Arms that even though they are not great on the tabletop, and even though that's not what a Bretonian army is supposed to be about, they're just beautiful. And actually, Evan's been painting some up and they've been looking great.
Thanks for saying that. I'm going to pick two, actually. I'm going to say that the overall best mini in all of Warhammer Fantasy is the Green Knight model, hands down. No ifs, ands, or buts. It's the best model. That's all I'm going to say about it. But another one that I love from the range is the Questing Knights. They just look so cool. They have so much character to them. I think there's only like 5 sculpts in that box, but each one just is like its own character. And just as like a side note, like 7 years ago, I had a new set of those in a box that I intended to paint up for my Mousseon army. And I saw that they were selling for like a lot of money on eBay. And at that time, a lot of money was $75 for that kit. And I just looked today, just out of curiosity, and people are selling it for like $200 now, which is just crazy.
Dude, I have some of those old Questing Knights that I've stripped, and I was looking like a year ago maybe, and like one of the particular sculpts that I think only came in the blister pack maybe was $140 or something. And these were actual bids on it. This wasn't just like someone's listing. I was just I've got like 2 of these, I think. I was like, this is insane, but like, I'm going to keep them because I love them, but it's just crazy.
I wish I had them back just to have them in my army now. But so that's I think the last models I'll ever sell because I always end up regretting selling them. So,
all right. Well, a number of us have played this faction on the tabletop. So what defines this army on the tabletop?
Yeah, that's going to change on the edition. So this is a 6th edition army book. And when I first started playing the army back in the early 2000s, I just bought the new models that had come out. I remember having a ton of success with the Bretonian army at the time because that was still back at a time when the person who charged went first and there was no step up and there was no striking back. And so if your Bretonian knights went in and killed the front rank, then your opponent didn't get to attack. The there was no steadfast, they would probably break from combat and be run down. And it was just a totally different gaming experience with Bretonians, as I found later on when 8th edition came out and I was still playing Bretonians. And steadfast and step up and combat based on initiative, not on the charge, it just totally changed how Bretonians play and what you're looking at when you're building a Bretonian army and how your Bretonian army is going to function on the tabletop. Between 6th edition just kind of charging up and smashing through and going through the lines, to 8th edition where Bretonians are more of a defensive army that's going to be harder to budge in close combat, hopefully, if you build things correctly. The concept of like really smashing through the lines isn't going to be there in 8th edition unless you get a triple charge, and that's pretty challenging to do.
To build on what Mike just said, it's a very tactical army. If you make small mistakes, they can be compounded very quickly. Part of that is due to the lance formation itself, like, because you want to take advantage of the lance formation, but it's also really hard to maneuver those things sometimes. They just have a really narrow frontage, so they have very narrow charge arcs, and then they also have super wide flanks. And when you're deploying them, you get them too narrow and close together. You sometimes can't even complete charges that you're trying to do because of the way you have to wheel or swing out. It just becomes too difficult.
If you don't mind me interrupting there, yeah, the reason that is because you get one wheel during a charge.
Right.
And so if you have to delay your wheel because that wheel would make the rear of your night bus run into another night bus, then you have to move them all the way out past the night bus beside them and then wheel. And sometimes to do that, it means that you're only going to be able to hit the flank of a unit that you're actually in the front of, which means you can't complete the charge.
Right.
So it's the fact that during the charge, you can't have your models move through other models, and that you only have one wheel during a charge that makes it unwieldy. And it means that when you deploy your knight units, you need to have them separated by a decent amount.
Right. You got to have proper spacing between them.
It might be counterintuitive to a lot of people, but based on my experiences with the gameplay, I mean, you're often better served being very conservative with your knights and letting your trebuchets, which are two of the most effective, maybe even the best war machines for their cost in the game, do some work on your opponents to soften them up to receive a charge where you may be able to break them based on dead pass considerations. You might have more ranks if you soften them up well enough with your shooting and your magic. It's a pretty kind of hang back and see type of army, more as a rush in and go fight stuff type of army.
Yeah, you have to be a little more opportunistic on choosing your fights based on your shooting or your magic.
Which doesn't mean that you don't have some units that can go out and be fighting in those early turns. It's just they're not fighting the opponent's major forces. They're clearing off chaff. They're taking out war machines. And we'll talk about what some of those units are, but you'll still have stuff to do. But yeah, it's using those trebuchets and other units to force them to come to you.
Because again, the list is a 6th edition one, you really don't have very much range of choices. You're on standard, combat lord, wizard hero, 4 core choices, 4 special, 2 rare. Compared to some of the other army lists, you aren't going to be able to surprise an opponent with something that they aren't expecting, as much as, say, dwarves could turn up with iron drakes, and if you haven't really played dwarves before, their mechanics might surprise an opponent.
Which you're going to see a lot of Bretonian armies that are very similar. They're going to have small differences either on magic item setups for their lords or numbers of knights they have in their units and that sort of stuff.
The main differences I'll usually see are if somebody wants to run a men-at-arms horde, that's just kind of something different than someone running 3 or 4 night buses. A men-at-arms horde changes the way you can play because it can break steadfast and it can make the army operate a little bit differently.
But what is also worth noting, towards the end of 8th edition, Bretonians were rare in tournaments, but when they appeared, they tended to punch above their weight. 2 main reasons for this. Firstly, anyone who was bringing Bretonians to the field had probably been playing them for all of that edition and at least one previous edition. So these weren't new players. They were people who knew what they were doing with the tools they had. But secondly, you generally only get 1 or 2 Bretonian players per tournament max. And so, yes, there's not that many choices, but if your opponent has never bothered picking up the Bretonian book and has no idea what anything does, everything was a surprise.
Mm-hmm. Getting familiar with your own army is much more important than playing a net list in many cases. Be familiar with your own army and then knowing what other armies can do. Before we go elsewhere, let's introduce the listener to the various units that we have. And let's start off with the Lord level characters.
So you have the combat lord, the Bretonian lord, pretty archetypical of most armies. The one thing he's got going for him is that you can take virtues on him, which are special rules available only to Bretonia. And these have varying degrees of power, but there's a couple that are really important. There's a couple that you're going to see that are kind of big. One of them is the virtue of heroism, which is FAQ'd to basically be heroic killing blow for your Bretonian lord. And this guy is just so dangerous to a lot of things in the game. Other characters, big monsters, chariots, just anything out there that's multi-wound that is hard for most human combat lords to deal with, he's going to be very dangerous too. Personally, I like to run him with a Sword of Swift Slaying, so he's always strikes first, a Dawnstone, an Enchanted Shield, so he's getting a one-up rerollable save. So he's very durable. He's got multiple saves kind of stacking on top of each other, and really you're just kind of fishing for those sixes on your to-wound rolls.
As a note, we did run a cheap character bracket to see which faction had a cheap character that would beat others. And the Killing Blow Bretonian Lord can come in below 250 points, and he won the bracket.
Yep, just fishing for those sixes, try and get the heroic Killing Blow on. So he can be very potent, and he's relatively cheap. The other one you can do is give him the Virtue of Knightly Temper, which is essentially when you cause a wound, you get another attack. It's very similar to the Blender Lord that you see in a lot of Vampire Counts armies with the Vampire Lord. I like to run him sometimes with the Cuirass of Fortune, which lets you re-roll ones when you're wounding. So that's just giving you an extra opportunity when you're striking, probably with your lance, high strength, to get you those extra attacks. And if you put that virtue and the cuirass on him, then you've got some more points that you can mess with if you want to give him a magic weapon or something extra like the potion of foolhardiness or a dawnstone or something like that. So the Bretonian Lord's for his points is very potent. You can build them a couple ways. There's lots of other things that you can do for them, but those are kind of the two main ones that you'll mostly see. I don't know if Mike has anything he'd like to add to that.
Yeah, you touched on it a couple times, but I think the biggest takeaway from the Bretonian Lord is he's 110 points base, and fighting lords in Warhammer 8th edition were kind of rare outside of like Beastmen. Vampire Counts obviously have a Vampire Count that's both magic and fighting, but a lot of the top tier armies isn't going to include a fighting lord. But the Bretonian Lord coming in at 110 points, getting to a 1+ rerollable armor save and heroic killing blow, coming in at less than 200 points or about 200 points is just incredible value for what you're trying to do. And it's not uncommon to see a Bretonian army even take two lords, because 110 points base is just super cheap.
Yeah, you could technically run both of those guys together. Mike, do you want to talk about the Prophetess?
Sure. Yeah, you got your Prophetess. I don't remember ever thinking that she was incredible value. I just, you know, she's pretty typical level 4, 300 points. She's going to be picking from the Lore of Life, the Lore of Heavens, or the Lore of Beasts. I usually run her with the Lore of Life. I'll put her in a unit of Knights of the Realm. I'll give her the Crown of Command, because based on the Bretonian special rules, a Prophetess will be placed in the second rank of a Lance, and they won't be subject to attacks by enemy models until they're either forced into the first rank because all the other knights are dead, or there's somebody in your flank and all the knights around her are dead. If you give her the Crown of Command and you're able to stick her in a unit of Knights of the Realm, they are not going to go anywhere as long as she's alive, and especially if the BSB is alive. And Bretonians have multiple options to pretty easily get to 1+ rerollable armor saves for their lords and fighting heroes. So they're very hard to budge. The Prophetess is pretty average, you know, casting wizard, doesn't have any real special abilities, some magic resistance. If you want to go into briefly talking about the magic items that are available to her, you have the Chalice of Malfur, which is on a 2+, you get an extra dispel dice, which is a wonderful item. And then you'll see the double dispel scroll in a lot of Bretonian lists, which is you can take the Dispel Scroll from the big rule book, and you can take the Silver Mirror, which also acts as a Dispel Scroll, and the opponent suffers a strength 6 hit, which is especially nice in 8th edition because it's so common to see your opponent's wizards miscast and come down to one wound, and then if you can pop a Silver Mirror on them while they're trying to cast a spell and take out an enemy wizard in that way, it's really nice.
Kind of fun to use the Silvered Mirror and the Feedback Scroll in a list too, because you could very easily just kill one of their casters between the two of those.
So when I'm making my Bretonian lists, I usually have a level 1 with beasts to get Wissens, and then I'll have my level 4 with life because it's such an excellent lore. I haven't really explored using heavens too much. Ryan uses heavens in his armies a little bit more. I guess I'm too competitive to use heavens.
He's a tryhard. You got to watch out for the tryhard. You know, the tryhard playing beastmen, Bretonians, you know.
Yeah. I'm trying the hardest I can with Bretonians and beastmen.
On magic, I do think what's interesting about the Bretonian magic phase is it's not a superb magic phase. It's got dispelling. The prophetess is great because she gives her unit stubborn. But life does work well with Bretonians just because they can, you know, regrow knights. That's a lot of point value that you're regrowing. The signature spell on life is not great in any situation, and it's particularly bad with Bretonians because you don't need another ward save on top of your ward save. But Flesh to Stone can do some work. The main thing is the Prophetess is a level 4. You might get some good spells off. It can be really helpful, but I don't think it's a stellar magic phase that goes above the norm of what other factions can do.
Yeah, and just building off what you said with like the Lore of Life, the lore attribute which heals wounds, when you have guys with 1+ rerollable armor saves and wounds do get through, you know your opponent's really excited to actually get a wound in, and then if you have a decent magic phase with the Lore of Life, you're going to be healing those wounds back up, so it's pretty demoralizing, I think, for a lot of people to have to deal with that.
Or if you take the locket and your models can only suffer one wound per phase.
Yeah, the Bretonian Army book actually has a ton of magic items. And when you combine that with the virtues that you can take, there's actually a ton of options.
It's a double-edged sword with that because there's like 50 magic items in the book or something crazy like that. But then you're also paying a lot more for some of those like basic magic items too.
I was going to touch on this a little bit later whenever we got to Damsel. But since we're talking about the Lore of Life, Mike and I actually had a game earlier today. And my war boss became very acquainted with the Lore of Life. A victim of Dwellers Below.
Yeah, so I managed to kill Brian's level 4 at one point, and so he was kind of magically defenseless kind of at the end of the game, and there wasn't so many things going on that I needed magic for, and I started Dwellerizing is a big unit with his BSB and his general just to see if I could make him roll a 6, and his general did indeed roll a 6.
Classic.
I like how that was turned into a verb.
Dwellerzing.
Dwellerzing.
The best way to avoid having your level 4 die and then you don't have magic defense is to never rely on magic defense in the first place and only take level 1. So, you know, you can do that.
Just imagining the thinking orc sticker right now.
Yes. All right, so we mentioned the damsel. Mike, I've played him a number of times as he played his Bretonians, and a level 1 damsel can be really nice. He runs his round on foot. I think that's it's a solid way of doing it. And Mike, I think you run beasts, right? So you can just have wizens and toss out wizens on stuff. Some will tell you odds are you should take a level 2 with wizens so that you get that +2 to your casting, and it works out with the dice better, but either way, a damsel with wizens, because that's the signature spell for the lore beast, is really solid. You can put her in a knight unit if you want, or you can just run around on foot. I will say sometimes Mike's damsel, and actually sometimes his prophetess, does not roll very well, and I think it's Mike's fault because he always rolls her attacks with the horses and just says the horse attacks. So I think he thinks that his prophetess is a bit horse-faced. And so I don't think she rolls very well for him.
It's Lucretia Belladonna. She's like the beauty of Teliot or something, right? I don't know.
Mike, you should mention the one downside of having the prophetess right in the middle of your lance formations.
So obviously we've been talking about the Lore of Life, and the Lore of Life is most known for Throne of Vines, which is the third spell selection in the lore, which if you get it off, you ignore miscasts on a 2+. But if you don't get it off because you have a really clever opponent who knows that they should definitely not let you get Throne of Vines off, if you take a look at the 8th edition miscast chart, It is extremely punitive towards things that are in base contact with your wizard. So if you miscast with your wizard inside a lance formation, the odds are very high that you're going to roll something that is either every model in base contact, which is going to be the three knights in front of her, the two knights to the side of her, and the three knights behind her are going to take a strength 10 hit, which is going to provide you with no armor save and a 5+ ward save if you haven't fled. Or it's going to be a small blast template, which is the same math. So if you have the misfortune of miscasting, trying to roll two dice for something stupid, you could very easily blow up eight knights, and then you're sitting there with the shell of a Bretonian army.
Yeah, very punishing.
I've experienced that on turn one a couple times in my life, and it's not a lot of fun. You feel a little limited.
Probably throwing two dice at something.
Yeah, trying to cast Awakening of the Wood or something, you know?
Right.
We also have the Paladin, who has primarily two main uses. So what do you use the Paladin for?
I've seen other people do different things. A lot of people who play Bretonians will rely on their hero selections and their lord selections. And some people will run like multiple Paladins. I run a BSB and I make them give them a 1+ armor save. You know, the three roll will just to keep them alive as best as I can, because a BSB is so important in most any army that's not undead or demons, just the ability to reroll your leadership tests. Then also, I would not leave home without a Paladin that's mounted on a Royal Pegasus. I find in 8th edition Warhammer that the ability to fly, the ability to have such freedom of movement and to put yourself in such important positions and to so quickly get to threats and to deal with things is so crucial, this freedom of movement. I get my Paladin on a Pegasus, the Sword of Strife, which gives him +2 attacks. So he's got 5 attacks base from him and his sword. Then his Pegasus is a couple of attacks and maybe a stomp. So he's really able to deal with most chaff in the game. He can clear things out for the knights, things that are in the way. He can go after war machines. He can fight things. He can come into the flank and do a lot of wounds. He's just a very versatile kind of Swiss Army knife character that you have on this Pegasus who can zoom around the battlefield and really help you in any number of situations. And he comes in at about 160 points, and I just think he's absolutely crucial. Kind of this a similar thing that you see with Dark Elf Pegasus heroes or an Empire captain on a Pegasus. These flying heroes are just really, really important in Warhammer.
While you're talking about it, Mike, another fun way to run the Paladin on a Pegasus is with the Worm Lance, which gives him a breath weapon. So you can do some of the other stuff you're talking about, like clear chaff out. But if you have like a really big horde, especially like lower toughness stuff, fly them up into the flank of there and shoot a flame template down their flank. You can get a lot of points very quickly for a guy that doesn't cost that much.
Yeah, that's a great point. A lot of people will run them with the Worm Lance. That's also a good build.
Now, is it right that the BSB comes for free?
Yeah, you don't have to pay the points for the BSB, but it is required. So you're always going to have to take
It's not the traditional 25 points.
Yeah, you're always going to have to take a Paladin BSB.
But he's pretty modestly priced. He's 60 points, and then you have to buy him a Warhorse. So he's 74 points. And then the Bretonian banners really aren't very good. You're much better off generally making him as hard to kill as humanly possible. The Bretonians are pretty effective at doing that. Just a combination of Enchanted Shield, Dawnstone, or Cromwell Great Helm, things that will pretty easily get you to a 1+ rerollable. This access to this 1+ rerollable, it's going to dovetail into another really important aspect of playing Bretonians, which is the notion of these character fronts, where you have these lances that are 3 models wide, and if you get characters with 1+ rerollables in the fronts and your opponent can't attack or hurt anything, it's going to make it really difficult for them to win combats against you. So that's a really important strategy and consideration if you're playing 8th edition Bretonians.
It's also really fun when you're running beasts. If you have Savage Beasts of Horus, you get a bunch of characters up in the front and pop that bubble, and you can do a lot of damage that way.
It's not reliable, but when it happens, you just wreck right. Face. Yeah,
right. That can turn the tide of a game pretty quickly.
All right. Well, let's go through core. Give maybe what they do, one job they do. So let's start with Knights Errant.
So, at 20 points ahead, this is probably the cheapest 2+ armor save cavalry in the game. They hit almost as hard as Knights of the Realm, but you are sacrificing some reliability and the ability to control them because they might charge without orders. They do have the option of taking a banner that gives them an extra +1 strength on the charge. So you're on basic humans, all the way up at strength 6 with lances on the charge, which is quite nice.
Then you have Knights of the Realm, which are just your bread and butter knights, higher weapon skill than knights errant. This is probably what you're going to build most of your army around, and we'll get into why in a minute, but these guys are probably, in my opinion at least, for 8th edition, slightly overpriced, especially like when you compare them to Empire Knights or Empire Knights Inner Circle. But overall, they're good. A 2-up armor save and the Blessing of the Lady, they're pretty durable.
You're going to see a lot of the Knights of the Realm on the table when you're playing against Bretonian or playing with Bretonian. You might see one Knights Errant unit. Occasionally, people will play Men-at-Arms. They are very basic, but they're worse than Empire troops. They have a lower weapon skill, and that means they're going to get hit more. They do have a pole arm, so it's going to be higher strength, but again, that lower weapon skill. And they're fairly cheapish at 5, so they're not bad infantry, but depending on how you're playing your army, they might go against the style that you're playing. You just have to be thinking about if they're going to match what you want them to match. But as I said earlier, I think they look amazing and I love them in an army.
Their value in 8th edition is being steadfast breakers. So Bretonians have a real problem with breaking steadfast. And if you have a unit of 40 and you can get them into a combat, it could really help break steadfast.
One other thing to note too, they're leadership 5, but the champion upgrade is leadership 6. So that has a lot of value in it in and of itself. And then also important to remember that if you're within 6 inches of a knight unit, you can use the knight's leadership as well.
Peasant bowmen, Bretonians are one of the few factions that has longbows, so that 30-inch range with the ability to potentially swift reform before firing. You've got a few other factions that have got that 30-inch range off crossbows, but those are move or fire. Because, again, this is an outdated book, they can buy an upgrade for all their shots to be flaming, but it's a 5 points per unit upgrade as opposed to points per model upgrade. So if you chose to take a horde of 40-odd bowmen, you can have all those shots flaming for 5 points. If you happen to know someone that runs a Throg list with just loads of trolls, they will hate you.
Yeah, and with the peasant bowmen, you're allowed to make one unit skirmish as well, and we'll get into this at some point, I would think, but you know, chaff and redirecting is a really important part of 8th edition Warhammer Fantasy, and you have very few options with the Bretonians, and making one of your units skirmish and giving them the ability to be annoying and get in the way of charges your enemy is trying to make is really important. So I always bring one unit of peasant archers that's skirmishing just to give me a unit of redirectors.
So with the topic of redirectors, we can talk about some special choices, because the other redirecting unit that you have available to you as Bretonians is the Mounted Yeoman. And most cheap redirecting, fast cavish type stuff in most factions is in core, or in a lot of factions is in core. But in Brett's, it's special. I think, just having played against Mike's, I love movement shenanigans, and I think they're really solid for movement shenanigans. There's been a number of infuriating times when I've had my Blood Knights with their frenzy redirected into oblivion by some Mounted Yeomen and effectively neutered in that way. So Mike does a good job using them, but I think they're pretty solid redirectors. So a unit of them is not a bad choice. And they're basically just peasants with some spears.
Right. We were talking to someone on the Discord the other day that was asking some questions about Bretonia, and they asked about Mounted Yeomen, and we're like, yeah, they're good. And it's not because they're good. It's just because fast cavalry are good. There's nothing special about them that makes them particularly good.
And fast cavalry in an army that can be unwieldy for the reasons we said at the very beginning.
Right.
You really need to maneuver your opponent where you want them. You need to get certain units of theirs out of position, and they're one of the only ones that can do it. The skirmished peasant bowman, the paladin on a Pegasus, your Pegasus knight.
Right.
You're also locked into taking both spear and bow on them, so they're not as cheap as they could be if those were options as opposed to compulsory.
Right. Well, someone want to take Pegasus knights?
Pegasus knights are, like a number of things we touched on, I would say are really important unit to the composition of most any competitive Bretonian army. They, like the Pegasus hero, provide you so much flexibility with their ability to fly. They're a little less defensive in the sense that they only have a 3-up armor save, but they also have the +1 toughness. They actually, for whatever reason, have +1 initiative. They're initiative 4, while everyone else is pretty much initiative 3 that's not a hero. And in an army that has these giant knight buses that have such little maneuverability and have such problems with their unwieldiness, these Pegasus Knights are just really important to either protecting a flank. So some people will use their Pegasus Knights to protect their trebuchets, and some will use them in a more offensive capacity to attack other war machines your opponent might have, or to be a threat to smaller units like chariots, or maybe even get into a flank of a bigger combat. But so much of Warhammer Fantasy Battles 8th Edition is movement and flexibility of movement is just so, so important. And it's such a decisive factor in games. And Bretonnia Knights do a really nice job of helping that. They are an O1 choice unless you bring a Lord on a Pegasus. So you're only going to have one unit probably, but they're pretty much an auto include.
Carrie, tell us why Questing Knights suck.
Questing Knights, prior to 6th edition, were just another unit of knights with lances. 6th edition decided to do something different with them and gave them great weapons, which immediately reduces their save in combat by a point. Back when charging units automatically went first, those great weapons had some potential to be as good as lances on the charge, and then you had a bit more hitting power in later turns. And these knights are up at strength 4 base, so you have got that going for them. The problem is you've lost that point of save and you are surrendering resilience. And you're paying 28 points ahead for this privilege. To go back to the comparison with Empire Knights, who have got an extra point of save and can just take great weapons, swapping out their lances, and have the option of the inner circle upgrade as well to become essentially questing knights, but in core, these are not really seen as a good use of your points or a good unit, except for fluff reasons.
I will say that fluff reasons are the best reasons.
So there isn't really much going for Questing Knights except fluff.
I haven't used Questing Knights in a very long time, so I don't remember, but is it that if you're mounted, a great weapon gives you only +1 strength as opposed to +2?
No.
I think that was 7th edition.
That was Cavalry Hammers.
Yeah, that was a Knights of the White Wolf thing, I think.
There was at one point, I think, where if you were mounted and using a great weapon, it was only +1 to your strength as opposed to +2.
Yeah, I think it was +2 when mounted in 6th, only +1 mounted in 7th, and then 8th, you're back to +2, but you always strike last even if you charge.
So Questing Knights in 8th edition are going to be strength 6?
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
All the time.
Are there any units that are possibly as bad as Questing Knights that are also in special?
Well, there's only one other one we haven't talked about.
I'll take this question. I don't play Bretonnia, but I have noticed that I don't really see Grail Knights and Battle Pilgrims in battle reports or brought to the table or really painted in Discord. So it doesn't seem, they seem either very rare or not a priority generally. So I was actually going to ask the Bretonnian gurus of our podcast why that is, why the Grail Relic and Battle Pilgrims don't typically seem to show up in general.
They are horrible. They are a terrible unit, and I'll tell you exactly why.
Can I guess real quick? Is it the 2-weapon skill? Does that contribute to it?
No.
It certainly doesn't help.
But what else? This is more of an addition thing, I think. So this is a 6th edition army book, and what happens between 6th edition and 8th edition is the game gets a lot more killy. And so you have Bretonnian Battle Pilgrims, which their value is that they're stubborn leadership 8. So they are basically an anvil that can go into things and stick them and tie them up for a long time. But they're kind of expensive. And between 6th and 8th edition, you had step up come into effect. You had horde formation. You had more killing. You had rerolls to hit come up with always strikes first. So they're not particularly durable. They don't have a good armor save. They don't have toughness 4. They're just toughness 3. With the addition of things becoming so much more killy and violent, they just tear through your theoretical anvil so much easier and quicker than they would have done in 6th edition. So You never really expected them to kill anything with weapon skill 2 and Hatred, which, you know, is 10 attacks at weapon skill 2, strength 3, which isn't very good. You were always hoping that they'd be an anvil, but with the way the game changed over the years, they can't even do that at this point. They're just a really expensive anvil for like half a turn, and then they just die.
They were also a real casualty of changes to how the sword and board worked, because back in 6th edition, that was a plus one to your save. So facing an anvil that has a 4-up armor and a 6-up ward off the blessing is actually pretty solid, certainly with the less attacks they'd be facing. Now that parry is a 6-up ward and they already have a 6-up ward,
right,
they've got this redundancy that they're paying for two things but can only use one of them.
Yeah, and if you want to make them an anvil, you're going to need a lot of them. And at that point, you're looking at 250 to 300 something points, and that's a big Bretonian lance, or it's 25 to 30 battle pilgrims, which are terrible. So it's just a huge point sink for a very inefficient and ineffective 8th edition army selection.
But people should take them because they are the funniest and coolest unit in the game.
I have a unit of 30. I have them. They exist, and they are painted to some degree, and I've taken them in games.
They look great. I've played against them and killed all of them. So.
Took about half a turn.
My Saurus ate some battle pilgrims.
Does it seem like you're paying for the cost of their high leadership? They have peasant's duty, so they're probably just would steal the leadership of the knight next to them.
What they have going for them is their stubborn 8, which is nice. That's okay. That's good. It's just it's not very helpful when they all die, really. Yeah, on to rare units.
So you mentioned before, does anyone take Grail Knights? I do take units of 3 Grail Knights. I tended to play much smaller points games than average back when this came out, so 1,000 points or so. And putting 120 points or less into 3 Grail Knights at low points costs is actually really effective and scales up quite well, because you have 120 points, a 3-wound unit that has a 2-up save, that has a 5-up ward, that on the charge is going to be putting out 7 strength, 6 attacks. That's pretty good. It's not amazing.
I think it's just 6, Kerry.
Pardon? A champion.
But they don't have a champion.
Oh, they don't. Yeah.
They're all champions.
Sorry. Oh, yeah, that's right.
That's the thing of playing too much Armies Project. They have champions again in there. So 6 strength, 6 attacks on the charge. The problem is they're incredibly frail. Still only toughness 3, even though these are supposed to be living saints. Bigger units of them, you're paying almost 40 points a model, you're not going to get your money's worth. That is that simple.
Yeah, the value of Grail Knights in 8th edition, you will see some people run bigger units. They do hit very hard. I would recommend anyone use a small unit, and this is why I think there's good value from the standpoint that they provide magical attacks to an army that severely lacks magical attacks. And if you're playing in a tournament setting or you just want a well-balanced army, a big problem for a lot of armies in Warhammer is an inability to access very reliable magical attacks, and that's important if you're going to run up against ethereal units, which you probably will. Having magical attacks when you need them is just so important. If you run up against an army of vampire counts with 4 or 5 ethereal units and the only magical attacks you have is your magic phase magic missiles and 1 or 2 heroes with a magic weapon, that's going to be tough. And so the value from the Grail Knights, I think, is a lot in the access to the magical attacks. And I think that a 3-man unit serves that purpose pretty well.
Finally, the trebuchet. Now, this, as mentioned earlier, is potentially considered one of the best war machines in the game, if not the best. And we've talked an awful lot, and I've given a lot of examples earlier of how the army list has been weakened by changes to the rules between 6 and 8. The trebuchet is the big example of it going the other way. Now, it is 1 point of strength all round stronger than your standard stone thrower with its template. And its points cost is based on anyone who is touched by that template but not covered only having half a chance of being hit. Now, 8th edition, all of those are hit. So suddenly that's a blob of strength 5 hits and you're deleting a good chunk of the unit. So, yeah, your standard Bretonian build is you take 2 trebuchets and are very happy about it.
Yep.
Yeah, there's just not enough good things to say about the trebuchet. I mean, one of the first things I think about is it's a war machine with 4 wounds. As Bretonian, you're always going to be going second, and you're probably going to run into opponents with cannons here and there. And so with four wounds, you stand a much better chance of actually surviving a cannonball than other war machines do. That kind of survivability plus the impact of a strength five small blast template on so many different types of armies is just so devastating. And only at 90 points, it's incredible value. Some people will try to defend their trebuchets from war machine hunters, and some people will just say that's 180 points. When it dies, it dies. And so people have different philosophies around how they protect or don't protect their trebuchets. They're an excellent unit, maybe the best war machine in the game.
They also combine well with peasant bowmen with braziers, because there's some monsters out there that run around with regeneration saves. If you can plink a wound off of one of those, like a hell pit abomination or something like that, and then drop a rock on it so it gets no save, that's really good value.
Definitely something you're going to see when you play Bretonians. Something you won't see as much because people don't play special characters as often are the special characters. We already mentioned there's not a lot available. What are they?
So you have King Lewin Lioncur, who you will never see on the battlefield because back in 6th edition, points costs were very different. Paying 728 points for someone who is going to die pretty easily, so someone worth significantly less in a challenge. He just does not have the staying power that, say, a standard Chaos Lord build, standard Vampire Count Blender Lord build. He might even struggle with some of the much cheaper options around, say, well-tooled up Archlector. That sounds like I'm exaggerating, but things like having regeneration when that's pointed for 5-up ward and a 4-up regeneration save, now those are one or the other.
Yeah, he's probably overcosted by about 100%.
Yeah.
I would maybe take him if he was 400-ish points, maybe. But he also does some weird things to how you can form your army. Like, he makes your men-at-arms and peasant bowmen count as special points.
Which isn't good.
Which is not good, no.
Yeah, he's 728 points, and his realistic value is less than half that, probably. A more effective lord choice is going to be a less than 200-point standard Bretonian lord, to be perfectly honest with you. Somebody with a 1+ armor save and heroic killing blow is far better.
That can be protected in some knights.
Yeah, it's, you know, they kind of dovetail into the Bretonian lord option to use a hippogriff, which is also one of the worst choices that I can even think of in 8th edition.
Very bad.
Completely horrible. I mean, it's a monster with four wounds, toughness five, no save of any kind except the blessing, and it will die to a unit of 10 archers shooting at it twice. It's just horrible. This is a larger 8th edition discussion with regards to like monsters and stuff, but it's completely horrible. Never take one.
But it's also worth noting that the Hippogriff model is probably the smallest model in the game that is classed as a monster. It even uses the same wings as a Pegasus.
Evan's favorite character, the Green Knight, is actually a pretty... I mean, he's overpriced, but he's a pretty good hero. I let Evan talk about him.
Oh, yeah, the Green Knight's great. You have to think of him as like an undead unit. That's how you kind of play him, because he doesn't have the unstable special rule, but his special rule is essentially the same thing. So you have to be really careful about what combats you put him into, but he can be a real pain in for certain other armies that aren't prepared to deal with him. And the best part and most fun part is when somebody actually does kill him, he has a chance to come back on the next turn. He can just kind of reappear back on the battlefield because he's just like an undead spirit. I've used him a few times to really good effect. He'll butcher like whatever chaff you want to put him against, throw him against units of knights, monsters that don't have magical attacks, and he'll do some good work for you.
Yeah, then we have the Fae Enchantress. Never taken her myself. She's got some kind of unique abilities. You know, just like most special characters in the game, probably way overcosted for what you can get out of a generic level 4 prophetess that you can kit out in any number of different ways. So I don't have a lot of familiarity with taking special characters. I mostly played in the tournament scene where these things were a little more uncommon.
Her cost isn't terrible. You're getting magic resistance 3, so finally into the bracket of your knights will benefit from this rather than it's just separate and useless. +1 to power dice and dispel dice. These are mechanics that really don't show up in 8th edition very much. Just getting free dice was very much phased out during 8th edition books. So there's a few things in there that are very useful. But for a standard point game, this is your entire Lord's allowance. everything in here needs to be working for you. Well, there's no point.
Yeah, 545 points.
You know, when you read through her rules, she's got a lot of rules, and she is pretty powerful, actually. But you almost never see her. I'm not sure.
I've never seen her.
That is, yeah.
I've used her for the aforementioned Civil War campaign I wrote, and her side was losing so badly by turn three that she suicide charged with her Grail Knight bodyguard into Malobord's Knights of the Black Grail. Did not go well, but it was hilarious.
Good on her.
As we're summing up, someone should play this faction if...
I would say you play... I'll tell you the reason I started collecting Bretonnia, and it was for the models. When it's well painted and all kind of displayed out on a table, I don't think there's any other army in the game that beats it for just the aesthetic look of it. It just looks so awesome. So I think you really have to like the look of it, because honestly, and we've gone over this, there's some real gameplay stuff that's lacking with it. I think it's its own little puzzle to kind of put together, and I think that's what kind of appeals to Mike, I would say, on top of liking the models and stuff. But I know for me, it was, I love the way this looks. I really want a painting challenge. I want to make every one of them unique, and that's kind of what made me want to collect them.
If you want to play as an underdog, both thematically and in terms of strength of list, this is really a good list for you. A lot of people view the Empire as the human faction where it's a halberd with some guts behind it, but they are propped up by the artillery, they're propped up by demigryphs, fantasy units. Here, you've got access to a monster that's rubbish, you've got your Pegasus Knights, but really what you're playing with here is humans. They might have some blessings on them, but if you win, if your lord runs up and heroic killing blows the enemy Hydra and the enemy Black Dragon, you can feel pretty smug about it, even if you lose the rest of the battle. Thematically, you've done your bit for preserving Warhammer World humanity.
I like that. That's good.
I would add that you don't want to play this faction if all you want to do with the knights is charge forward and run into stuff, because they're just not strong enough to blow through units because of the steadfast rule. Even though that might be what they look like they want to do, you can't play that way with success.
Every Warhammer Fantasy Battle army I've ever played has been some draw with regards to the lore. I've never been in the scene and saw how armies played and thought, oh, I want to play that army on the tabletop because it plays on the tabletop in this certain way. There's something about the lore of Bretonnia, them being the good guys, even though they have problems with regards to, you know, class issues and stuff like that. They're still theoretically on, you know, the good guy side of the docket. They're fighting a good fight against chaos, and they've got these beautiful knights. And if you're able to collect an army and take the time to paint it, it's a pretty rare thing to see a fully painted Bretonnian army on the table. But if you really put a lot of time and effort into it, it's really breathtaking and one of the best things you can see on a tabletop.
But one of the reasons they're rare is that it can be hard to find the actual GW models. So how do people get a Bretonnian army?
So if you're going for official models, you are going to be spending a lot of money on secondhand. You might be able to run into people who've still got sealed boxes on frame. I'd recommend a second mortgage if you're looking at that. The plus, though, is that because this is essentially a historical-themed faction, there are a lot of third parties out there that offer options. So things like Perry Miniatures, Fireforge Games with their Devolt range. There are lots of places to pick up pretty high-quality plastic multi-part knights, plastic multi-part archers, peasants. You will find yourself then having to either convert or go further afield for things like the Reliquary, but most of the Bretonnian range is available from third parties with different sculpts if you don't want to be destroying your bank balance chasing official Games Workshop models. So Pegasus Knights are, I think there's two different manufacturers doing them. Fireforge do them, as do Norba. Norba Miniatures has put out a lot of third-party sculpts for more or less the entire Bretonnian range now. Obviously, we as a podcast are not recommending manufacturers other than these are the miniatures that are there. We would recommend doing your own research into things like delivery times and any other issues with companies' reliability.
There's a couple other companies that sell STLs for your 3D printer as well. Highland Miniatures is one of them. Lost Kingdoms also makes a Bretonnian-esque range. So those are a couple that you could, if you have your own 3D printer at home and are looking at collecting this army, they've got a lot of different sculpts that match up well to the Bretonian army book.
And I'm not sure if either of those sell out their STLs for Etsy shops, but I know sometimes you can look on Etsy shops and they'll have a license from someone who's designed something and you can just purchase straight from there if you don't have a 3D printer. Although, and again, you are getting more expensive with that, but it's still cheaper than straight GW.
It seems like STL sellers are more and more pulling the models straight from Total War Warhammer. I know they did a really great range of the Orcs and Goblins, and there's been some Skaven, and there's been some Empire. So if Bretonnia hasn't been made, I'd be surprised if Bretonnia isn't going to show up on those STL sellers' sites at some point in time.
With Bretonnia, it really is. How important to you is it that they look like GW Bretonnia, right? Because you can get a lot of, you know, slightly smaller knights from historical miniatures, or you can get STLs that are pretty close but more expensive than, say, Fireforge. So, you know, it really just depends on how important it is to you that you nail that GW look.
Yeah, I think the 5th edition range and the 6th edition range, that they're slightly different from each other, but there's a thread through them anyway. And I think they look great. So I think everything in my army, as far as I'm aware, is GW original. But I've also seen plenty of other people make Bretonnian armies with some of these companies that we've mentioned. Don't feel like you have to do Games Workshop if that's not available to you.
As Evan pointed out, he actually has done a Muzulon army as well. And so that's a mix of the Vampire Count models that some or most are still available from GW combined with old Brett models. Is that right?
Yep. Yeah. That was a project I started like 7 years ago or so, and kind of petered out when AOS launched. And then when I kind of got back into the game, three or four years ago, kind of continued that project. But in the meantime, I also decided I wanted to do a more traditional Bretonnian army, and that was simply just to paint them, really.
And they do, as we've mentioned, look great. Again, all of us are on the Warhammer Fantasy Discord, and you can go and chat and hang out. For some of our podcasts, you can go in there. I'll ask for user questions, or you can just ask a question if you know what we're talking about. That month, we'll answer those. But before we go, we want to give our kind of final idea of where we rank this army book. I don't know if anyone did this. This is our first one. What we're going to do is in the future rank army books according to lore, aesthetics, and power level. That way it matches all gamers. Some of you just want to win, so you'll know where they are in power level. Some of you only care about lore and whatnot. But since this is our first one, we'll just give an idea of where we think this army is going to rank for us among all the army books. Is there someone who wants to give a general, this is middling, this is low for you on this ranking for lore, for aesthetics, and for power level?
I'd say for lore, I'd rank it right in the middle, just as a baseline for going forward with this. I think it's fun. It's parody, or not a parody, but it takes inspiration from Arthurian legend, other like medieval folklore and that sort of stuff. So it's got some fun stuff in that. I'd say for aesthetics, I would say it's my favorite looking Warhammer army. So that would be top 15th out of the 15, I think we would say. For power level, it's definitely one of the weakest books for 8th edition, and I think that's pretty general consensus among people. Some people will say Beastmen are lowest or Tomb Kings are lowest or whatever. I would say they're probably third. I would say Tomb Kings and Beastmen are below them, but we can suss those out as we do more army books.
I agree with Evan that for lore, I see it as middling. I don't think it's anything special, but I do think there's some fun stuff in there, like the problem of vampirism being there. So there's some good lore stuff. I don't think it's the most stellar, so I'll think it'll be in the middle. Aesthetics, I think it is a beautiful army, but it also requires someone who is at least a patient or willing to learn painter. If someone's a beginner and they're starting with this army, they will really need to do some practicing beforehand. And so I think for aesthetics, I do think it can be in the upper middle for me, or maybe even in the upper tier, but only when a skilled painter is doing it. And then power level, yeah, it's in the bottom three or four.
Am I a skilled painter, Ryan?
No comment.
That's a good point. You are going to have to buy a lot of different paints.
Yeah, that's another thing. They're beautiful. And yes, Mike's are beautiful, and I enjoy playing them. I look forward to him completing them and actually playing a game with the fully painted army. Since I brought a fully painted army, I thought that maybe he would next time.
Deep cuts.
I'm a bad friend slash opponent.
What else? Anyone else?
Yeah, I mean, I'll go ahead. I mean, obviously, I've been playing Bretonians for a long, long time, and I absolutely adore them. From a personal perspective, a lot of people might say the lore is kind of middling, but for me, it's in the top tier. It's one of my two or three favorite armies. Just the Warhammer universe having Bretonia, I think, it enriches it a lot more, and there's a number of armies I'd lose before I lost Bretonia. I really enjoy kind of the different machinations that you can come up with in regards to battles that might take place in the old world with Bretonians and how that might come about. From an aesthetic standpoint, I...
Wait a second, Mike. I have a question. Would the armies that you would get rid of before Bretonians be every army that's stronger than Bretonians?
So it's Beastmen versus Bretonians.
I mean, Beastmen and Bretonians are two of my favorite armies. It's well established.
And he's been sniffing around Tomb Kings as well.
I have been sniffing around Tomb Kings as well. But anyways, it's a personal thing. It's a personal preference. I love the Bretonian lore. I love the aesthetic. I mean, for me, it's the number one. I think it's really challenging to paint. It really requires a skilled painter. And something similar, I would say, like about Wood Elves. It's just like if you're jumping in, if you're playing Warhammer Fantasy Battles and you're trying to start by painting, you know, beautiful Wood Elves or beautiful Bretonians, like that's hard. It's not easy to make them look beautiful. When you do see it, it's really awesome. And with regards to power level, you know, most people are going to have them in the bottom three. I've seen a lot of people that I look up to either online or in real life take them to tournaments and do quite well with them. It is possible to win with Bretonians. They have their limitations, but Carrie was saying earlier, a lot of people who play them have played them a long time and they're really knowledgeable and skilled Warhammer players, and you can do a really good job with them, I think, in the right circumstances. But from an overall power of the book standpoint, yeah, I guess I'd have to agree that they're in the bottom three. But you know, in the right hands, they can win tournaments.
I'd say top five for lore, sort of middle of the road for aesthetics, not necessarily because you can't do an amazing looking Bretonian army, but because they are very much a rarity. And then gameplay-wise, bottom five, certainly, if you're looking at an average player, what can they do with this?
And Carrie's was short and sweet. I'll keep mine short and sweet as well. I really enjoyed the lore. I've mostly consumed Warhammer in general through the lore while I've been out of the hobby. And then I came back in with just the one army so far. But I would definitely say that I enjoy the grittiness of the later edition, but the little bit of hamminess that gets thrown in during different pieces or in the flavor text of some of the units. So I would say that it's definitely in the upper ranks of lore for me. Definitely the upper ranks for aesthetics for me as well. A fully painted army of Bretonians just looks amazing on the tabletop, and it's really cool to see the knights and lance formation just moving across the table. So upper half for the aesthetics for me as well. I don't know that I could probably give a good accounting of power level just from personal experience, but of the armies that I've played against, I would say that it takes a pretty skilled player to make the correct decisions with the army. So that might make it a less new player friendly army, making potentially the army probably the lower half, but a skilled player I think can do well with the army, just what I've seen.
I will, if I could, one thing before we close. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that one of the users on the Discord had made their own 8th edition update to this army book that I think is really good. So if you want to check that out, you can either ping me at Durger on there or ping him directly at Ravenclaws. He put a lot of nice work into it, and I think it keeps the 8th edition army book flavor very well. If you're interested in that, just send us a ping.
I enjoyed hanging out with y'all tonight, so I think we should all say good night to each other, and I hope that we haven't been horsing around too much.
Oh, geez.
And that this was a good way to herald in a new time, heraldry in a new time for this podcast.
Good night.
Good night. Thanks, all right. Everybody.
All right. Well, that's all we have for today. We hope that next month you'll gather around the Hearthstone with us again.